But perhaps we were wrong in that. It was all John could do to stop himself from walking out. Was he supposed to churn butter and sew doublets like a girl for the rest of his days? "May I go?" he asked stiffly. "As you wish," Thorn Marsh responded. Darren and Sam left with him. They descended to the yard in silence. Outside, John looked up at the wall, shining in the sun. The melting ice, creeping down its side in 100 thin fingers. John's rage was such that he would have smashed it all in an instant, and the world be damned. "John," Samuel Tarley said excitedly, "wait. Don't you see what they're doing?" John turned on him in a fury. "I see Sir Alice's bloody hand, that's all I see. He wanted to shame me, and he has." Darien gave him a look. "The Stuarts are fine for the likes of you and me, Sam, but not for Lord Snow." "I'm a better swordsman and a better rider than any of you," John blazed back. "It's not fair." "Fair?" Darien sneered. "The girl was waiting for me, naked as the day she was born. She pulled me through the window. And you talk to me of fair?" He walked off. "There's no shame in being a Stuart," Sam said. "Do you think I want to spend the rest of my life washing an old man's small clothes?" "The old man is Lord Commander of the Night's Watch," Sam reminded him. "You'll be with him day and night. Yes, you'll pour his wine and see that his bed linen is fresh, but you'll also take his letters, attend him at meetings, squire for him in battle. You'll be as close to him as his shadow. You'll know everything, be a part of everything. And the Lord Stuart said Mormont asked for you himself. When I was little, my father used to insist that I attend him in the audience chamber whenever he held court. When he wrote to Highgarden to bend his knee to Lord Tyrell, he made me come. Later, though, he started to take Dickon and leave me at home, and he no longer cared whether I sat through his audiences, so long as Dickon was there. He wanted his heir at his side, don't you see? To watch and listen and learn from all he did. I'll wager that's why Lord Mormont requested you, John. What else could it be? He wants to groom you for command." John was taken aback. It was true. Lord Eddard had often made Rob part of his councils back at Winterfell. Could Sam be right? Even a bastard could rise high in the Night's Watch, they said. "I never asked for this," he said stubbornly. "None of us are here for asking," Sam reminded him. And suddenly, John Snow was ashamed. Craven or not, Samuel Tarley had found the courage to accept his fate like a man. "On the wall, a man gets only what he earns," Benjen Stark had said the last night John had seen him alive. "You're no ranger, John. Only a green boy with the smell of summer still on you." He'd heard it said that bastards grow up faster than other children. On the wall, "You grew up, or you died." John let out a deep sigh. "You have the right of it. I was acting the boy."
"Then you'll stay and say your words with me?"
"The old gods will be expecting us." He made himself smile. They set out late that afternoon. The wall had no gates as such, neither here at Castle Black, nor anywhere along its 300 miles. They led their horses down a narrow tunnel cut through the ice, cold dark walls pressing in around them as the passage twisted and turned. 3 times their way was blocked by iron bars, and they had to stop while Bowen Marsh drew out his keys and unlocked the massive chains that secured them. John could sense the vast weight pressing down on him as he waited behind the Lord Stuart. The air was colder than a tomb, and more still. He felt a strange relief when they re-emerged into the afternoon light on the north side of the wall. Sam blinked at the sudden glare and looked round apprehensively.
"The wildings, they'd never dare come this close to the wall. Would they?"
"They never have," John climbed into his saddle. When Bowen Marsh and their ranger escort had mounted, John put two fingers to his mouth and whistled. Ghosts came loping out of the tunnel. The Lord Steward's Garen wickered and backed away from the direwolf.
Do you mean to take that beast?
Yes, my lord, John said. Ghost's head lifted. He seemed to taste the air. In a blink of an eye, he was off, racing across the broad, weed-choked field to vanish in the trees. Once they had entered the forest, they were in a different world. John had often hunted with his father and Jory and his brother Rob. He knew the wolf's wood around Winterfell as well as any man. The haunted forest was much the same, and yet the feel of it was very different. Perhaps it was all in the knowing. They had ridden past the end of the world. Somehow that changed everything. Every shadow seemed darker, every sound more ominous. The trees pressed close and shut out the light of the setting sun. A thin crust of snow cracked beneath the hooves of their horses with a sound like breaking bones. When the wind set the leaves to rustling, it was like a chilly finger tracing a path up John's spine. The wall was at their backs, and only the guards knew what lay ahead. The sun was sinking below the trees when they reached their destination. A small clearing in the deep of the wood, where nine weirwoods grew in a rough circle. John drew in a breath, and he saw Sam Tarly staring. Even in the wolf's wood, you never found more than two or three of the white trees growing together. A grove of nine was unheard of. The forest floor was carpeted with fallen leaves, blood red on top, black rot beneath. The wide, smooth trunks were bone pale, and nine faces stared inward. The dried sap that crusted in the eyes was red and hard as ruby. Bowen Marsh commanded them to leave their horses outside the circle.
"This is a sacred place. We will not defile it."
When they entered the grove, Samwell Tarly turned slowly, looking at each face in turn. No two were quite alike.
"They're watching us," he whispered. "The old gods."
"Yes," John knelt, and Sam knelt beside him. They said the words together, as the last light faded in the west, and grey day became black night. "Hear my words and bear witness to my vow," they recited, their voices filling the twilight grove. "Night gathers, and now my watch begins. It shall not end until my death. I shall take no wife, hold no lands, father no children. I shall wear no crowns and win no glory. I shall live and die at my post. I am the sword in the darkness. I am the watcher on the walls. I am the fire that burns against the cold, the light that brings the dawn, the horn that wakes the sleepers, the shield that guards the realms of men. I pledge my life and my honor to the night's watch, for this night and all the nights to come." The woods fell silent. "You knelt as boys," Bowen Marsh intoned solemnly. "Rise now as men of the night's watch." John held out a hand to pull Sam back to his feet. The rangers gathered round to offer smiles and congratulations, all but the gnarled old forester, Dywin.
"Best we were starting back, my lord," he said to Bowen Marsh. "Dark's fallen, and there's something in the smell of the night that I mislike."
And suddenly, Ghost was back, stalking softly between two weirwoods. White fur and red eyes, John realized, disquieted. Like the trees. The wolf had something in his jaws. Something black.
"What's he got there?"
asked Bowen Marsh, frowning. "To me, Ghost." John knelt. "Bring it here." The dire wolf trotted to him. John heard Samwell Tarly's sharp intake of breath.
"Gods be good," Dywin muttered. "That's a hand."
Eddard. The grey light of dawn was streaming through his window when the thunder of hoofbeats awoke Eddard Stark from his brief, exhausted sleep. He lifted his head from the table to look down into the yard. Below, men in mail and leather and crimson cloaks were making the morning ring to the sound of swords and riding down mock warriors stuffed with straw. Ned watched Sandor Clegane gallop across the hard-packed ground to drive an iron-tipped lance through a dummy's head. Canvas ripped and straw exploded as Lannister guardsmen joked and cursed. "Is this brave show for my benefit?" he wondered. If so, Cersei was a greater fool than he'd imagined. "Damn her," he thought. "Why is the woman not fled? I've given her chance after chance." The morning was overcast and grim. Ned broke his fast with his daughters and Septa Mordain. Sansa, still disconsolate, stared sullenly at her food and refused to eat. But Arya wolfed down everything that was set in front of her. "Syrio says we have time for one last lesson before we take ship this evening," she said. "Can I, father? All my things are packed." "A short lesson. Make certain you leave yourself time to bathe and change. I want you ready to leave by midday. Is that understood?" "By midday," Arya said. Sansa looked up from her food. "If she can have a dancing lesson, why won't you let me say farewell to Prince Joffrey?"
"I would gladly go with her, Lord Eddard," Septa Mordain offered. "There would be no question of her missing the ship."
"It would not be wise for you to go to Joffrey right now, Sansa. I'm sorry." Sansa's eyes filled with tears. "But why?"
"Sansa, your lord father knows best," Septa Mordain said. "You are not to question his decisions."
"It's not fair." Sansa pushed back from her table, knocked over her chair, and ran weeping from the solar. Septa Mordain rose, but Ned gestured her back to her seat. "Let her go, Septa. I will try to make her understand when we're all safely back in Winterfell." The Septa bowed her head and sat down to finish her breakfast. It was an hour later when Grand Maester Pycelle came to Eddard Stark in his solar. His shoulder slumped as if the weight of the great maester's chain around his neck had become too great to bear.
"My lord," he said, "King Robert is gone. The guards give him rest."
"No," Ned answered, "he hated rest. The guards give him love and laughter and the joy of righteous battle." It was strange how empty he felt. He had been expecting the visit. And yet with those words, something died within him. He would have given all his titles for the freedom to weep. But he was Robert's hand, and the hour he dreaded had come. "Be so good as to summon the members of the council here to my solar," he told Pycelle. The Tower of the Hand was as secure as he and Tomard could make it. He could not say the same for the council chamber.
"My lord," Pycelle blinked, "surely the affairs of the kingdom will keep till the morrow, when our grief is not so fresh."
Ned was quiet but firm. "I fear we must convene at once." Pycelle bowed.
"As the hand commands."
He called his servants and sent them running, then gratefully accepted Ned's offer of a chair and a cup of sweet beer. Sir Barristan Selmy was the first to answer the summons, immaculate in white cloak and enamel scales.
"My lords," he said, "my place is beside the young king now. Pray give me leave to attend him."
"Your place is here, Sir Barristan," Ned told him. Littlefinger came next, still garbed in the blue velvets and silver mockingbird cape he had worn the night previous, his boots dusty from riding.
"My lords," he said, smiling at nothing in particular before he turned to Ned, "that little task you set me is accomplished, Lord Eddard."
Varys entered, in a wash of lavender, pink from his bath, his plump face scrubbed and freshly powdered, his soft slippers all but soundless.
"The little birds sing a grievous song today," he said as he seated himself. "The realm weeps. Shall we begin?"
"When Lord Renly arrives," Ned said, "Varys
gave him a sorrowful look. "I fear Lord Renly has left the city."
"Left the city?" Ned had counted on Renly's support.
He took his leave through a postern gate an hour before dawn, accompanied by Sir Loras Tyrell and some 50 retainers.
Varys told them.
When last seen, they were galloping south in some haste, no doubt bound for Storm's End or High Garden.
So much for Renly and his 100 swords. Ned did not like the smell of that, but there was nothing to be done for it. He drew out Robert's last letter. "The king called me to his side last night and commanded me to record his final words. Lord Renly and Grand Maester Pycelle stood witness as Robert sealed the letter, to be opened by the council after his death. Sir Barristan, if you would be so kind." The Lord Commander of the King's Guard examined the paper. "King Robert's seal and unbroken." He opened the letter and read, "Lord Eddard Stark is herein named Protector of the Realm, to rule as regent until the heir comes of age." "And as it happens, he is of age," Ned reflected. But he did not give voice to the thought. He trusted neither Pycelle nor Varys, and Sir Barristan was honour-bound to protect and defend the boy he thought his new king. The old knight would not abandon Joffrey easily. The need for deceit was a bitter taste in his mouth. But Ned knew he must tread softly here. He must keep his counsel and play the game until he was firmly established as regent. There would be time enough to deal with the succession when Arya and Sansa were safely back in Winterfell, and Lord Stannis had returned to King's Landing with all his power. "I would ask this council to confirm me as Lord Protector as Robert wished," Ned said, watching their faces, wondering what thoughts hid behind Pycelle's half-closed eyes, Littlefinger's lazy half-smile, and the nervous flutter of Varys's fingers. The door opened. Fat Tom stepped into the solar. "Pardon, my lords, the King's steward insists." The royal steward entered and bowed. "Esteemed lords, the King demands the immediate presence of his small council in the throne room." Ned had expected Cersei to strike quickly. The summons came as no surprise. "The King is dead," he said. "But we shall go with you, nonetheless. Tom, assemble an escort if you would." Littlefinger gave Ned his arm to help him down the steps. Varys, Pycelle, and Sir Barristan followed close behind. A double column of men-at-arms in chainmail and steel helms was waiting outside the tower, 8 strong. Grey cloaks snapped in the wind as the guardsmen marched them across the yard. There was no Lannister crimson to be seen, but Ned was reassured by the number of gold cloaks visible on the ramparts and at the gates. Jaina Slint met them at the door to the throne room, armoured in ornate black and gold plate, with a high-crested helm under one arm. The commander bowed stiffly. His men pushed open the great oaken doors, 20 feet tall and banded with bronze. The royal steward led them in. "All hail, His Grace, Joffrey of the Houses Baratheon and Lannister, the first of his name, King of the Andals and the Rhoynar and the First Men, Lord of the Seven Kingdoms and Protector of the Realm," he sang out. It was a long walk to the far end of the hall, where Joffrey awaited atop the Iron Throne. Supported by Littlefinger, Ned Stark slowly limped and hopped toward the boy who called himself King. The others followed. The first time he had come this way, he'd been on horseback, sword in hand, and the Targaryen dragons had watched from the walls as he forced Jaime Lannister down from the throne. He wondered if Joffrey would step down quite so easily. 5 knights of the King's Guard, all but Sir Jaime and Sir Barristan, were arrayed in a crescent around the base of the throne. They were in full armour, enamel steel from helm to heel, long pale cloaks over their shoulders, shining white shields strapped to their left arms. Cersei Lannister and her 2 younger children stood behind Sir Boros and Sir Merrin. The queen wore a gown of sea-green silk, trimmed with Moorish lace, as pale as foam.
On her finger was a golden ring with an emerald the size of a pigeon's egg. On her head, a matching tiara. Above them, Prince Joffrey sat amongst the barbs and spikes in a cloth of gold doublet and a red satin cape. Sandor Clegane was stationed at the foot of the throne's steep, narrow stair. He wore mail and soot-grey plate and his snarling dog's head helm. Behind the throne, 20 Lannister guardsmen waited, with long swords hanging from their belts. Crimson cloaks draped their shoulders, and steel lions crested their helms. But Littlefinger had kept his promise. All along the walls, in front of Robert's tapestries, were their scenes of hunt and battle. The gold-cloaked ranks of the city watch stood stiffly to attention, each man's hand clasped around the haft of an 8-foot-long spear tipped in black iron. They outnumbered the Lannisters 5-1. Ned's leg was a blaze of pain by the time he stopped. He kept a hand on Littlefinger's shoulder to help support his weight. Joffrey stood. His red satin cape was patterned in gold thread, 50 roaring lions to one side, 50 prancing stags to the other.
"I command the council to make all the necessary arrangements for my coronation," the boy proclaimed. "I wish to be crowned within the fortnight. Today I shall accept oaths of fealty for my loyal councillors."
Ned produced Robert's letter. "Lord Boris, be so kind as to show this to my Lady of Lannister." The eunuch carried the letter to Cersei. The queen glanced at the words. "Protector of the realm," she read. "Is this meant to be your shield, my lord? A piece of paper?" She ripped the letter in half, ripped the halves into quarters, and let the pieces flutter to the floor.
"Those are the king's words," Sir Barristan said, shocked.
"We have a new king now," Cersei Lannister replied. "Lord Eddard, when last we spoke, you gave me some counsel. Allow me to return the courtesy." "Bend the knee, my lord. Bend the knee and swear fealty to my son, and we shall allow you to step down his hand and live out your days in the grey waste you call home." "Would that I could," Ned said grimly. If she was so determined to force the issue here and now, she left him no choice. "Your son has no claim to the throne he sits. Lord Stannis is Robert's true heir."
"Liar!"
Joffrey screamed, his face reddening.
"Mother, what does he mean?" Princess Marcella asked the queen plaintively. "Isn't Joff the king now?"
"You condemn yourself with your own mouth, Lord Stark," said Cersei Lannister. "Sir Barristan, seize this traitor." The Lord Commander of the King's Guard hesitated. In the blink of an eye, he was surrounded by Stark guardsmen, bare steel in their mailed fists. "And now the treason moves from words to deeds," Cersei said. "Do you think Sir Barristan stands alone, my lord?" With an ominous rasp of metal on metal, the hound drew his longsword. The knights of the King's Guard and 20 Lannister guardsmen in crimson cloaks moved to support him.
"Kill him!" the boy king screamed down from the Iron Throne. "Kill all of them! I command it!"
"You leave me no choice," Ned told Cersei Lannister. He called out to Jaina Slint. "Commander, take the queen and her children into custody. Do them no harm, but escort them back to the royal apartments and keep them there under guard." "Men of the watch," Jaina Slint shouted, donning his helm. 100 gold cloaks leveled their spears and closed. "I want no bloodshed," Ned told the queen. "Tell your men to lay down their swords, and no one need—" With a single sharp thrust, the nearest gold cloak drove his spear into Tomard's back. Fat Tom's blade dropped from nerveless fingers as the wet red point burst out through his ribs, piercing leather and mail. He was dead before his sword hit the floor. Ned's shot came far too late. Jaina Slint himself slashed open Varley's throat. Cain whirled, steel flashing, drove back the nearest spearman with a flurry of blows. For an instant it looked as though he might cut his way free. Then the hound was on him. Sandor Clegane's first cut took off Cain's sword hand at the wrist. His second drove him to his knees and opened him from shoulder to breastbone. As his men died around him,
Littlefinger slid Ned's dagger from its sheath and shoved it up under his chin. His smile was apologetic. "I did warn you not to trust me, you know."